Welcome, everybody. This is SharePoint Weekly. This is episode 53, or is it 54? 53. Did I actually mess it up?
So.
I think it's 53.
Yeah.
Way too many.
Who counts, right?
Yeah, who counts? Now, it is 23rd of September 2019, and we do not have any visitors. How did that happen? No, that was by design.
Yeah, exactly. Right. So we had a different idea for today's episode, basically to reiterate something that we touched on a few times already in the past. I was like, you know what, like it would be good to talk more about that, because we realized that time over time it comes up, and then not always it's clear like what the difference between one and another.
Yeah. You want to be there?
Yes. So today, today we'll talk about difference between building projects as opposed to building products.
Yeah.
And we'll bring our experiences, and in a way they are kind of the same. Like, we used to do projects and now we are both doing products.
True. I was thinking this before. I didn't say this before I started recording, but I started my career on building projects, then I moved doing products, and then I moved back on doing projects, and now I'm back in doing products. So it's kind of a
So in a way, are you trying to say that you can make up your mind whichever you like more?
Yeah, well, actually, yeah, that's fair. But it's an interesting theme, at least for me. I've seen this in the past as well. So when I first was doing customer projects, we did a large customer project, actually really interesting customer project. It was a travel booking solution, which was, we were developing that already in 2001. Think about the timeline. For Nokia originally, and then a few other customers, where the point was that you could actually go to a extranet website and then buy your flights and hotels and everything else. And this is 2001. So it was way ahead of its time. Unfortunately, the company who actually we created that for was unable to really make success out of that product as such, which is a pity, because it was way ahead of its time. It was a really cool setup. It was actually developed in a way, sorry for spending 2 minutes on this, but it was really cool. So you could actually install the solution to your intranet as a running intranet solution. So you didn't actually go to any and sign into another service, because that was too complex at the time, but you had the internal identities and all of that running in your intranet. Then when you click a button, it actually then communicated using really weird technologies, because the technology wasn't really there on the services of the travel booking system. So it's really, really cool. So
nice.
Anyway. And then from there, doing a product development, invoice automation, and then back on Microsoft doing projects, and then now in engineering. So what about you? What's your background on this? You have enough expertise to talk about this topic.
I hope so. I might not have the expertise, but I do have experience.
Yeah,
I've been building websites and web apps since forever. I recall building my first, when I didn't even have a PC, I would have to. So I had Amiga at home where I could emulate DOS, but I couldn't see it. So I remember when in DOS I would type HTML, and to be able to see that, I had to go to the neighbor who had Windows 95 PC, and I could see it then in IE3.1. Right? So that gives you basically the timeline about like how much back I go there. And then from there, I went through things like PHP, JavaScript, doing the whole thing. And then at some point, I rolled it into SharePoint. That was late 2006.
We actually started in SharePoint at the same time frame. So.
There you go. Right? I mean, and my first, so I think it, like the first few years that I was working with SharePoint, I would build exclusively internet sites.
Yeah,
exclusively. Well. I think I built my first intranet in 2010, 11 only.
Yep.
Like until then, it's all internet sites, because I had so much expertise with HTML and the web that was more of the area. Exactly. And then kind of like there was no more work around that. So I was like, okay, there is an intranet. I was like, intranet, that's funny.
That sounds interesting.
Well,
global intranet and a .com site are pretty close, right? And there's not a massive amount of differences. There's certain, obviously, collaboration sites is a difference.
Yes, exactly.
But corporate communicational sites, they're pretty same as .com sites.
Exactly. Exactly. Right. Because like even internally, companies often want to have these tailored, highly controlled experience, as opposed to, you know what, we want to use whatever is available out of the box. We want to make the best use of our investments, as opposed to have the thing just shine and express our identity.
As
company.
But oh boy, the times have changed. If you think about even the global intranet timeframe, those projects were up to 4.5 million euros or $6 million when you work with the global customers and then you brand the intranets and all of that. And nowadays, those kind of projects, not necessarily.
Well,
there.
I don't know. Like my last experience with projects is, I think, 3-4 years back. And I guess even now, right? I mean, there are big brands that do, let's say, market-facing things like big commercials. Exactly, or campaign sites. And there is, I think, the money for that is still there.
Yep.
But it's hot. It's I think it's more complex now to explain the investment in a corporate site internal only, where the brand is really so important.
True. And plus the time that at the time it was always the, we're gonna now invest 500,000. That was roughly the typical sized projects which I used to actually do, 5,000, 400,000 or whatever the projects. And then we kind of reinvest this in 3 years when this intranet is out of date. So it was kind of the way of thinking on the investments was completely different. You always had a budget to a certain level and then you did that, and then you are running with that one for a certain while, and then a revamp, maybe to another technology, who knows?
So exactly.
But now when we are in a cloud platform, and it changes the whole way of thinking, because again, it's more iterative way of doing development. Maybe maybe the money is exactly the same, but it's being approached in a different way. And it's more on, let's say, gaining immediate value out of the investments in the smaller portions, which actually makes a lot of sense, rather than having 500,000 or whatever. My largest project was 32 million, but that was together with Windows client site refresh and all of that. But then there was like 16 .com sites and a lot of interesting stuff behind the scenes.
Nice.
Yeah. Anyway, so the topic was around the customer projects versus products. What would be your kind of the definition? How would you approach the difference between a product and a project?
I think so. The one that is really the most important from the way where I see it, is that a project has a clear start and an end.
Sure.
And no matter if it's a fixed price or not, there's always, I think that also defines the word, like project has always a clear start and finish. Product has not.
Yeah,
product is that ongoing thing that you can always improve and evolve to other things, and there is never end to it.
True.
And I think it took me quite some time when I switched companies and also roles, is basically to realize that there is always more work left to be done than hours in a day. You will have, and if you do things right, you will always have more ideas. You will always have new experiments. You will always have things that you've heard that you want to try, that you are interested in. Would it work? So as such, you will have a never-ending things list of things that you could do. And if you don't watch out for that, you will get really stressed out. Because that list will never be empty. If you used to be a person like inbox zero, empty to-do list, that will never happen in product. Never, ever, ever.
True. Yeah, definitely true. And it's an interesting, as a project, I'm sure if we think about, let's say, classic SharePoint releases, which were once in 3 years, you might say that that was a project as well, because it had a timeline and release timeframe, but still, you tend to keep on evolving on top of the existing product as well. And with the customers, there's always the sign-off, and then it's like, okay, bye-bye. And sure, there might be a maintenance job and all of that, but that's a separate discussion. The project is anyway signed off by the customer at a certain point to be, but now it's delivered. Now it's I accept this and I work it to go, right?
Yeah. Yeah, but I guess like even in the past, right? Even if we get back to reality of a few years back, where SharePoint was shipped every three years, like regularly we would hear that building the product actually would be just a little part, like only maybe even a few months of the 3 year a window. So that we won, and then the moment engineers were done with what was supposed to be the next version shipped, like they would not sit still for 2 years. They would either go build other things, or they would start building and planning, scoping the version the after race. That would be shipped over 6 years.
Yep, absolutely.
Imagine that, right? Imagine, like, in today's reality, how can you predict what would company need in 6 years?
Yes.
That's true. At times it's really hard to fathom, like, what would you need in a year? Because technology goes so fast, and nowadays, like back in the days, they were like, SharePoint was this big thing, and competitors were probably comparable, like fair big size solutions.
Yep.
Nowadays, if the marketing team needs a space to collaborate, they can look as well, I don't know, Dropbox, Trello, they can combine, maximum, like whatever works for them.
Yep.
So they don't always look comparisons at your size and feature breadth as opposed to the ease of use and how long does it take to set it, because time to market is the key, not the what you have to offer.
True. And that's actually really huge, let's say, change in the IT world as well. When I think of it, in the past, IT was really the controlling these things, and kind of IT was even the one who was leading the projects and funding the projects. And that has changed in the last decade to be business-driven way of thinking. So it's more about really, truly the value. It's not about anymore IT controlling and restricting what can be done. IT has to help the business to deliver the value for the project, which is really interesting as well. Now, one of the examples which I talked about on the past, one of the things which always bothered me when I was doing these projects, and still kind of it's mind-blowing in the idea how the IT actually works, is that in these customer projects, this is still true, customer always signs off when the delivery is done, when the project is done, right? And you as a vendor, if you're a vendor, you basically want them to sign off, because basically then it's like, okay, we got the money, and that's the final pay of the money. But it's kind of, let's say, it's interesting. I'm trying to figure out how to weigh this in a way. I can't use curse words. It's kind of messed up when I think of the fact that customers are buying expertise from these IT companies because they don't have it. But then at the same time, for the delivery, they need to sign it off, as in, no, we actually got what we requested from a functionality perspective, but also technically, this is the quality of what we were requesting and aiming to do. So we sign off and we will pay you. And after that, poof, the vendor is gone.
Well, but I guess the same way, you do exactly the same when you let somebody build a house. Like, at the end, you pay,
absolutely.
You are the owner of the
house.
Which and is if kind you of... feel like you don't... It's weird, but that's the way it works, right? Like, you become the owner. So you have to say, like, I'm okay with that. And I think it's more easy than ever. Right? Like, that's with a house, in a way, it's more obvious that I am not an expert. I cannot judge whether the walls are straight and whether everything stands right. So what you do, you typically you hire somebody else to assess the building, assess everybody.
Exactly.
Right? So because you want to have somebody who is expert, but it's not the company you hired initially, you want to have somebody else to assess that and basically tell you.
How do you validate that person has the right expertise to actually validate the other company to sign it off, which is really interesting as well.
So in construction, because it's so important thing, like if a roof of whatever is built like falls down, that is a critical failure.
Sure.
Like it will cost lives.
Yeah.
When your internet breaks, like nobody dies.
Yep.
So I guess that the whole field.
Hopefully.
And that's even an interesting thing, because a while back, I had an interesting discussion with somebody whose family member was a real architect in construction.
Yep.
And the person, like, they had to go through so many assessments, certification to be able to call themselves that way. And that person found it hilarious that we in the IT call ourselves architects.
Yes,
exactly. But we have no credentials to back it up with. Because, like, how are you equipped to assess things that is the right way to do, right? And there's who verifies that whatever you says is okay, right? None. Like unlike a doctor or an architect in construction, like everybody can just start building sites and maybe 9 out of 10 times it will be fine, right?
Sure, sure. But that really, if you think about the IT, we in Microsoft world, we tried this with the master certified people, with the master certification program, right? We actually came up with this highly expensive 3 weeks on site or 5 weeks on site, depending on a program.
Yep.
Microsoft trained, and if you pass the program, you can call yourself as a Microsoft certified master, which as a title sounds so weird. But anyway, I'm a master. Call me master. But anyway, that even that program was forced to shut down because of the IT is evolving so fast. Well, there was obviously numerous other reasons as well, but because of the IT is evolving and technology is evolving so fast, there's no way for these people to keep up with the technology unless they're willing to pay a significant amount of money. But and the question is maybe we should have that kind of a program still, because right now we don't actually have any certification or credentials so that you would be able to call yourself as say, well, I'm the guy who can actually approve this stuff or not.
I know my stuff.
Yes, exactly. Now, and that's relates on so obviously as a Microsoft consultant, we quite often got tracked on this customer engagement and all of that. I still remember this one really large project which I was signed into review. Funny enough, they were not willing to use me during the development time, but they wanted to actually get a Microsoft sign off before they go live with their .com site, which is like, and then you review the solution and they built that for 1.5 years and it was complete crap. Well, and it's like,
you can almost expect that, right? If you don't involve the expert from the start.
Exactly. Which is like, why do you do this? What? And then they needed to actually, because it was a publicly, it's in the stock markets, so they needed to actually officially sign the investments off in their quarterly release because it was such a big investment. It was a large company, so it wasn't really a massive, huge deal. But it's like, it's one of those things where, well, maybe we should have some sort of a way of having the right credentials from a day one rather than, but there is no really truly trusted way of doing this, right?
Yeah. And I guess so. And that will be the last comment that I make on it. And then let's get back to our discussion about the project products.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because like in the end of the day, and that's something that I realized only after I basically move out of the project space, is that from the customer point of view, in the end, every vendor will say they're the best, and and the customer is not equipped to assess that. The customer is like, okay, how do I tell different? Because they have exams. Well, everybody can have an exam. So
there are gold certified partners and silver certified partners.
Yeah, but that's marketing. That's
exactly.
Marketing.
Yeah. Yes, it's not black and white, because you get as long as you get a certain amount of certificates in your company, you will get a gold certified certification. Now, it does not mean that any of those people who actually have the certificate will be delivering the projects which you're paying for, which is really
challenge.
Unless customers are demanding.
And then even then you could demand it, but even then, like, how up to date the exam is versus technology that you want to use in project.
Yep.
So they're it's really hard to make it foolproof.
Yep.
In a way, but it's so important to get the end result right.
Yep, absolutely.
And with that, let's flip back to the discussion that we had originally. Because like one thing that I recall back from my days in projects was coming across issues in product.
Yep.
Something didn't work as expected, or something worked quite correctly, or there were docs missing. And oftentimes I was younger and more eager to do things and more direct, like, and I would like so often have like, Microsoft, you're so big. Why don't you just fix it? Like exactly like that. And it would just cover like my emotion around that thing. Like, why don't you just fix it?
Yeah, Microsoft just doesn't get it, right?
Exactly. Like how can you not know? Like, this doesn't work.
Yeah.
So how do you, like, what is your first person experience from the product side of things, like when you get to hear or when you see remarks like that, like, why are things the way they are?
Now I need to be really careful because Jeff might be watching or listening this. Now, but it's one of those things, obviously, there's a if we think about the product size of a SharePoint, there's multiple ways of using the product. There's multiple interests of using the product. There's multiple experiences, and it's being bent by the partners and customers in a different ways, which you wouldn't even believe. But it's one of those things where even though we have 120,000, 140,000 employees, I don't have any clue, actually. It's not like for every single product, there's say thousands and thousands of developers and engineers who would be skilled to maintain that. Or the fact that even if we would know that there's a certain amount of bugs or known areas which we haven't really evaluated, it might be worthwhile to still go live because there's a time to market. We need to go live so that we don't lose the customers to the, let's say, other competitors with whatever we have, and then we evolve the version and the product afterwards as based on the customer feedback. And that's actually really much why we do this minimal viable product releases. And this really comes down on the fact that, let's say, quite recent example is the Bates layouts. Bates templates, modern Bates templates, which basically are something which you can save, any page you can save as a Bates template, and then create a page. It's awesome, but then it's like, well, this works only in a one-site collection. So Microsoft, why didn't you actually consider implementing this cross-tenant so you would be able to save the templates in the cross-tenant way? And the answer is, of course we did. But what we wanted to do first is get the minimal viable product, the basic experience for customers to give us feedback. And then they will flag that, well, awesome, this is great, but I need to do this in a tenant level, which is like, okay, we have these plans already waiting here. And let's prioritize those on top of the, let's say, some other modernization or modern capabilities. And let's make that happen because so many customers are requesting this. And that's really the way of thinking this. Well, a lot of the functionalities in modern SharePoint or in SharePoint in general, just like step number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, or there's conceptual plans, but then we always start by going live with the step number 1. So we get the initial feedback, we can evolve that and maybe see that maybe wait a minute, the step number 2 doesn't seem to be the right thing to do, but maybe if we go to step number 3 immediately and combine that. Because then we can, in the modern world, in the world where we're releasing a new version every single week, we can do this. And at the same time, we need to do this because otherwise we'll lose our customers to the competitors, right?
Yeah.
Did I answer your question?
Yes. And I guess let me add a few things from my own experience to that.
Absolutely.
Like one, no matter how many engineers you have, you would never have enough of them to do everything you want. Why? Yeah.
That's true.
It's like going back to what I said at the start, you have always so many more ideas. There are always so many experiments you want to try. There's always more. And the more your team grows, well, the more experiments you will want them to run. So it will never, and there will be stuff. The more things you build, the bigger there is that something might not work for someone. So that needs to be fixed as well. Yep. Right. So it's just.
And based on the customer demand and feedback, you can actually increase the resources, even though now you have, like, let's say, 2 engineers. And then if the customer's like, oh, this is the best thing ever, you get 8, and then you can prioritize things or whatever.
Exactly. But even then, you'll have more ideas, more customer, more ideas, more feedback that you have to process, more PMs, more teams. So it's just like that's realities of life. You will never have enough engineers to do everything you want to do, right? So like one, it's not that there is unwillingness of PMs at Microsoft not to do things. It's just realities of life. There are not enough hours, not enough hours in a day, and people do it, right? That is one. And two,
and it's like, step-by-step process. Absolutely.
Exactly. And exactly that, right? I mean, you could imagine that you would say, you know what? We will not release modern until we have full parity with everything.
Whatever that means.
Well, imagine that you would get this full list of things you could achieve in Classic, and then you want to say, you know what? Before we go live in the modern experiences, we will just do the whole thing.
Yep.
It would take you so much longer. It would aggravate everybody across the road. And as you say, you would probably lose people over that because you haven't innovated.
Yep.
Whereas now you say, nobody says we are done yet. This is just the first step in the longer process that we will do over time, and we will evolve to basically try to modernize things, improve things to the current way we see things. We have to start somewhere, and want to start with where can we add the most value first?
Correct. Correct. Creating, that really comes down because the most value in a short time frame, so that people are interested in using Office 365 because that's where we're getting the money. So,
yeah, exactly. And I guess that, like nowadays, because as you say, you can release every week. I think that in a way it simplifies things, because imagine what happened in the past. You had a release window once every 3 years. Yep. The consequence of missing the window was what?
It was huge.
Three years.
Yes.
It was not another week. It was 3 years. So often you would say, like, you know what, developers, like, you really had to get things done on time or they wouldn't be shipped maybe even at all, because in 3 years' time, like,
plus the fact that the way of doing the engineering at the time was that you basically had an idea. You thought, and sure, we had interviews with customers and research and all of that, but it's like an assumption. We're betting on this thing. We're thinking that this is the best thing ever. Let's say this the catalog search, catalog-based websites, .com sites is the best thing ever, and we bet X amount of investments on that. We're not going to comment on that. We're going to bet X amount of investments on that one. And then you go live with the SharePoint 2013 release, and you're kind of crossing fingers and saying, well, we invested X amount of money on that. Hopefully somebody's getting that. And it's an interesting balance. And based on that release and those yearly releases, then you needed to do marketing, documentation, guidance, and everything as a big bang. Now we actually evolve the stuff all the time based on, oh, that's missing, let's actually go there, fix that one, and then let's go on that side, so which is super important as well.
Yeah.
So one step at a time. One thing what I wanted to actually just, let's actually wrap up, because we need to go to the articles pretty soon.
Oh, right, we had the other thing too.
Yes, indeed. But one thing what's actually really interesting in the products as well, obviously projects has a life cycle, but every single product has a life cycle as well, which is really, really interesting discussion point. If you think about, for example, and obviously I love all of our competitors and all of that, but if you think about even Google is a text box in internet way, which you use all the time for searching functionality.
Well, it's one aspect of it, right? There is a big company,
but the majority of their revenue actually comes out of that text box, right? They're trying to expand
ads
at the moment. And ads, ads in that text box, because that's how it works. Now, but all of those, that product has a life cycle as well. It's the same applies actually for Microsoft products as well. So it's always the trying to figure out what is the next product, which is then rising and getting the revenue because the one product is going down. And when is the time to actually start investing to the next product more? Or do we evolve and refresh the existing products, which we've been doing now with SharePoint, because the classic SharePoint wasn't any more that compelling, right? So we needed to do a refresh so we get the product back on track on the usage. But if you think about the Google is such a great example. I just took the notes here because it's such a great story. It always makes me smile, because back in 98, Google got an offer for selling them the technology with the guys had actually done, to Yahoo for $1 million. So Yahoo basically said for the Google guys back in 98 that, hey, whatever you have, well, actually, another way around. Google guys were trying to sell themselves to the Yahoo and say, hey, Yahoo, so we have this great technology which we created, and would you buy us for $1 million? And Yahoo said, yeah, not interested, which is okay. So back in 2002, Yahoo offered $3 billion. So that's 4 years later, Yahoo offered $3 billion of the Google.
3,000 times more?
Yes. And basically, and Google said, no. But let's actually do this in $5 billion. And Yahoo said, no, that's not enough. And we're not going to increase the offer from $3 billion to $5 billion. Now, in 2002, I was, let's see where I was working. I was probably working in, actually in customer projects still. And maybe the Alta Vista and everything else was already going down, and Lucas and Google was going up. And maybe that would have been a good buy for Yahoo. So back in 2008, I still remember this, because I was already working in Microsoft. 2008, Microsoft offered $40 billion to buy Yahoo, which is like, what? And especially at least in Microsoft Finland, a lot of the consultants, everybody was like, whoa, why?
Why?
why would, are we sure that this is the smart thing to do? Sure, we have money. That's not the problem, because Microsoft has been highly profitable for the life cycle of the Microsoft. That's not really the problem. But $40 billion? what? And I still remember sitting in Tech Ready. Tech Ready is our internal conference where Steve Ballmer is on a stage explaining why this is the best deal ever and we're going to actually make it happen. Back in 2008, is it autumn or January timeframe? I can't remember. But that was interesting. And Yahoo said, no, we're not interested. We're not going to do this. So $40 billion. Not interested. And then now in 2016, Yahoo was sold to Verizon for $4.6 billion. And I don't know what's left out of Yahoo because I don't know anybody knows anything what's left out of it anymore. But it used to be number one player. If you think about MySpace, that's a product as well, right? It used to have a massive usage. Then AOL integrated that. Where is AOL? I don't know. It's all gone. A lot of these big Netscape. Think about that. Netscape was the number one browser at some point. But then there's products like Skype. We, as Microsoft, we bought Skype for $8.5 billion. Again, remember the year, and I don't have the years written down. But $8.5 billion back in, like, when was it, 5, 6, 10 years ago? I can't remember. And now we are kind of obvious that Skype still exists, and a lot of technology is getting now used in this discussion as well, because we're using Teams. And we had Skype, we had Lync, and then we had Skype for Business, and now we have Teams, which is interesting evolution of things as well.
I think before that, there was also the Office Communicator.
Oh, that's true. Yes, there wasn't the Office
before
Communicator.
Link.
Yes, that was before Lync. Yeah, that is true. Or is it Office Communicator was actually Lync, right? Because
no,
it was Lync.exe.
Link
I can't remember.
Was after that.
Okay. Anyway, which reminded me on Groove.
Groove, yes, of course.
And that was pretty
OneDrive, right?
OneDrive, yeah, that's true. And then that the Groove was renamed to be a SharePoint workspace, right?
Correct.
And then, but it was still Groove.exe, which was actually running behind the scenes.
Yeah, because there were probably dependencies on the name allocation of the file namespaces. You don't want to change that, yeah.
But it's when I think about this journey, there's a lot of let's say company product names and releases and functionalities, but then things evolve. It's actually interesting that SharePoint product name has existed this long. And maybe for a while it was actually going away because we even renamed SharePoint as Sites in the Office 365.
Yeah, but I mean, like if you think about over times, it used to be what? In 2003, what was it? SharePoint Team Services?
Yeah. Yes.
Then we had the Microsoft Office SharePoint Server, Windows SharePoint Services. That was in 2007, then in 2010.
Same thing.
Exactly. Yes. Well, there was no Moss anymore in 2010.
No, was it in there might have been 2010 when we changed that to SharePoint Server. So it wasn't Microsoft Office SharePoint Server anymore. It was just SharePoint Server.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So even there, you kind of see the kind of like is it this, like does it make more sense to combine with that, like basically trying to like realign things and improve the value add and value prop
and reset also the situation, even the Windows what was it
Windows SharePoint Service.
Yeah, exactly, that was free, right?
Yes,
but then
absolutely.
The additional thing was that if you buy the MOS on top of it or SharePoint
servers then you get really the business, the value add. And in a way, like I'm curious with that. Like, will we ever see a freemium version of Office 365, consumer grade?
Yeah,
because there is the OneDrive and OneDrive for business, right? And there is also in the Google space, there is the free docs versus the company. So, and in OneDrive already, you have files, right? You can create files. So will we have like simplified versions of that?
Who knows?
Exactly.
Who knows? And one of the things, what I want to still say on the products, there's actually two. Remember Google Plus? Plus was actually interesting. And the amount of money was actually poured on that just to have a competitor for LinkedIn. For Facebook. But that just didn't take off.
But I mean, that's also the one thing that you do in products that you don't really do in projects.
Yeah.
Or at least that's also the funny thing that I really realized the other day. Like, in products, if you do it right, when you want to try something out, because in products, like you don't really know things. You can lie to yourself as much as you like, but oftentimes you have an idea, you make an assumption, you want to run an experiment.
Yep.
And like the goal is to try as many things as you like as many things as you can, as quickly as you can, so that you know what fails, and you will like you won't have like the chance to for you to come up with an idea, and that being success is very close to a zero. Yeah. So instead, you test your assumptions with the market, customers,
experiments,
and you do, yep. and you rinse and repeat, and you rinse and yep. repeat, and you rinse and repeat. In a way, the same thing, like we used to do the same things in projects as well. But then the funny thing is that we never really called it out as well. Because let's try this new framework. Let's try to do Angular as opposed to AngularJS. Let's do things in Vue. You run an experiment. But because you haven't really called it out as such, you would have this additional cost cutting in the revenue and profit. But nobody really able to explain, like, why is it like that? Yeah, because things take more time than, like, why? Sure. Why didn't we, what is the business benefit of doing things in Angular as opposed in Angular 1?
Why would we
switch from Grunt to Gulp if we already had the whole build done in Grunt?
No one. If it's already working, why are we doing that?
Because that's often the inability or the difference between managing product is being often done from the more business side, whereas projects are often led by, or technology in that is often led by architects, and that never really sips into the, let's say, the business side and the price you offer and the cut of the distinction between profit you make versus investment you do in learning new technology stack.
Super classic example for those who've been around for a long time. Back in 2010 timeframe, I think SharePoint 2010, we were getting all the time feedback on why won't you update a .NET framework version, or was it 2013, to .NET 4.2 or 4? Why don't you do that in a service pack 1 or 2? The answer is, well, it doesn't make any sense. The investment versus the value out of gaining that from our perspective would have been zero. It's just doesn't make any sense.
Engineers are not the, as you have already seen, engineers, like, it's not an argument you can make to it, because they want to work with the latest and greatest.
Absolutely. And they can justify this by saying, but I can actually increase my implementation quality, and that would help you as well, which is true. But again, it's the value versus investment. Coming back on your experiments, especially in SharePoint Online, we actually do that nowadays all the time. We do experiments, and then we have telemetry, which is telling us how the funnel actually works. So we understand that if we change this to here, and does it actually increase the usage in this area, which was the objective, or do we do it in here?
But also with those things like rings and flights.
Yes, exactly. Well, the rings are more for Microsoft Teams, but the targeted release and the non-targeted release and all of that stuff, that really comes down on the similar way of thinking. And in SharePoint Online, we can easily do that because, again, weekly releases. Now, in on-premises, you can't do experiments in on-premises releases because how would you get the telemetry? You can't.
Yeah, and even that, like, how can you remotely enable a flight?
Exactly. You can't. It's impossible. So it's an interesting discussion. Now on the final topic on the products, LinkedIn. We bought LinkedIn at $26.2 billion a few years back, and still I think we're in the process of getting it truly, integrated on for example in Microsoft Graph potentially and all of this area. It's a massive interesting area. $26.2 billion. That's quite a significant amount of money, considering the fact that we bought Nokia phones for, what was it, $7.2 billion? So, which wasn't highly successful, but okay.
If you think about potential, is there, right? I mean, I don't know how many folks are there, but it's a lot, and it's their professional life is on there.
Yes,
their networks, and imagine like being able to tap into that from your collaboration space into that, and to integrate that.
With and the permissions of the users,
of course. I mean, it's not going to be like we just enable it and we have access to everything. No. Of course, it's going to be done the right way. But if you
think about it with Microsoft Graph as well. So.
Exactly. I mean, and if you tap into that and combine it with the power of AI, machine learning, and the capacity that you have in the cloud, abilities on that, and use that scale to tap into the insights and the signals that you have there combined with your work environment. That's it makes perfect brilliant. Sense.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. That's going to be really interesting to see where we'll end up with that journey. Absolutely.
Exactly. So I think the promise is there, and in a way that explains the value.
Sure.
Now we only need to see the end game.
Yep.
But yeah.
Whatever it will be, because probably we can't even visualize or think through what the end game would be. So
and it will probably change over time as well, right?
That
because that's again a specific thing in product.
True.
Things change over time.
Well, now I'm going to spend 2 minutes on that one. That reminded me on the similar way of thinking is that pretty recently I was thinking this when I was walking with the dog outside. Well, it's interesting if you think about the product direction versus your career direction as well. If you think about my career, I've never been able to say what I do in 5 years because I don't even want to think what I'm doing in 5 years because that would actually set something on a stone, so to say, that I'm going to be there on 5 years. But rather think the direction where you're heading, and that's where you will end up somewhere in 5 years, which should be in the range of good things, right? Because as long as you have an idea on, well, that seems like an interesting path, let me actually go there. And then that path opens up another path. It's the same with product development.
Well, but I guess in a way, maybe that's comparable more towards your ambitions and saying it's in 5 years, I want to lead a team of 10 folks and I want to be working on, you know, so as opposed to, I want to be working on this piece of code.
Sure, absolutely. Absolutely. But you can't actually see yourself. It's one of those in really, at least from my perspective, if somebody's asking me where you see yourself in 5 years, it's like, well, where do you want to be? Where do you see me in 5 years? Where would you want to be? What do you have to offer for me where I want to be in 5 years? Is that something which I would like to do? I don't know. But hey, I don't know where I'm going to be in 5 years.
Yeah, but I guess like it isn't bad. Like there is not like you have to, like I recall very good discussions that I had exactly that, like every single year, the yearly eval, like, okay, where you want to be the next year? I don't know. Like back in the days, I just want to do cool projects, work with modern tech. Like that was what drove me and do that. I mean, like I didn't have back then aspirations to become manager or team lead or CTO or CEO. Like, no, that wasn't the case, right? I mean, and it's also a part of the, I think it's tough. It's tough because when you end up managing a team, it's really hard to ensure that everyone's happy and like you empower them to achieve whatever they want to do. And maybe for some folks, it's like they're okay with coming to work and doing the best because, and that is it. And that is perfectly fine. Like not everybody has to be this, you know, the 10K engineer where, you know, they do everything like better and they wanted to grow. Sure, I mean, you can do that. But even that, at some point, there is limits to that.
Sure.
Because maybe that person will get a child and then their reality like overnight will just like flip from one extreme to another.
Yeah.
And there goes your plan.
Yep. Absolutely. Absolutely. No, let's actually not actually spend too much time on that one on today, but that's a good discussion point as well. Now, let's actually have a quick look on the articles. We'll kind of scan them through today relatively fast. We're so good on these 20-minute podcasts and videos. So, this weekend, there's a three SharePoint conference, SharePoint Saturdays. So the SharePoint Saturday Helsinki, I will be presenting there as well. Apparently, it's getting sold out, so looking quite good. The speaker list and the session list is quite good. A lot of well-known MVPs, but also definitely some locals from a Microsoft, so Flowcup Finland people. But a lot of familiar faces, MVPs across the world. This is being organized by Jussi Mori and Jussi Roine, who has a lot of connections, obviously, on the people across the world. So really nice set of people. Looking forward on catching up with a lot of these people actually on the speaker dinner as well. Then there's the SharePoint Saturday Los Angeles, where there's a massive amount of awesome speakers as well, and well-known MVPs, Microsoft employees as well. So really cool list of people, great set of people. Mike Fitz there as well. Jax is doing keynote, if I remember correctly, on the LA, but a lot of familiar faces here. And then there's the SharePoint Saturday Richmond as well. A lot of speakers as well. Definitely good looking set of sessions. Let me get in here. From SharePoint framework, Graph, usage, integration of Vue, Power Apps, Flow, Office 365, looking really, really good. And also not just the development side of the Open Source House, but also usage and end user driven topics in here as well, up to the level of, what was it? Who's using SharePoint? That's an interesting actually topic based on experiences on that.
Yeah.
Good. Then let's move to the Microsoft side of the house. So Microsoft Tech Community, the official SharePoint blog. There's a good blog post from Scott Stewart. He's a senior program manager or program manager from Microsoft side, and he's leading this Bates diagnostic tool effort, which basically is giving you insights around your modern pages, or I think it's actually supporting classic pages,
yes.
Classic
yes,
as
both.
Well, which is
yes.
Super, super valuable. Basic idea is that it gives you areas where you should be looking into on improving your current page. As an example, web parts using iframes or large images was a good example, which unfortunately isn't in this picture, but it's a good example. If you're using massive pictures, no wonder your page load time might be small if you're explicitly using a megabyte size pictures, right?
So in other words, if you experience slow pages, you might want to try this tool to learn more about what might be the potential cause.
Correct. And we're looking into integrating this tool also on the support processes. So if people are having slowness on their sites, then we're requesting people to install this tool so we can analyze, okay, so what exactly is causing that slowness? Is it your internal network? Is it this web page? Is it the server side? Because that's always, there's so many, let's say, areas which could actually be the root cause of the slowness of your SharePoint site.
What might be, really, be another interesting thing, like if we compare this, for example, to Power Apps, in Power Apps, in the app experience, you have a tool that allows you to check whatever you have built.
Yep.
I can imagine this being a part of the SharePoint page experience where you have a button being an admin or assuming given you have enough permissions, then you can just click the tool and see directly within the context of the page what this page does. And I mean, maybe it wouldn't be an option because it has to monitor network stack and all of that, but something around that, like integrate that in where people are in that experience as opposed to require a different tool.
Absolutely. Right now, it's an add-on to Chrome or Microsoft Edge. So that analyzes the network traffic as well, like you said, Waldeck.
Yeah.
So, good. Then moving here, deploy corporate SPFX pages. This is basically from Yannick related on app pages and how you can control their visibility and avoid them to be available for everybody versus only for some people. So really nice set of guidance and an example how to make things happen. So how to have a single page experience which end users cannot actually edit, as an example. So because that's really the key idea of the app pages as well. So if the user doesn't have the sufficient permissions, it is a lockdown page, and the lockdown page is then controlled by you as a developer or designer, what's actually on the lockdown page. Maybe we should actually, we definitely should have more guidance on that pages, because I think the functionality itself is super, super awesome. But what are the opportunities of actually using that? So really cool.
Absolutely.
Stuff. Now, then these following two are kind of debatable, but we wanted to call them out. They're good blog posts from Ram, and this one was from Jeff. But this one is around how do you can hide a site header. So having an application customizer added, which is actually hiding the header if needed. And sure, you can absolutely make this happen. You can relatively easily do that by just hiding a certain div class, because that's what that is. But we're talking about DOM injection, DOM page, DOM structure manipulation of the page. So this only works if and until we change that data automation ID or the main header or the structure of the page. And that might happen because we are releasing new versions every single page.
And that is an important thing. Page DOM is not an API. There is no SLA on it. And as such, there is no reason for you to give upfront notice of that div will change tomorrow. Like, no.
Yes.
Like you can change it as you need. And so why do you let's say, reserve yourself the right to change that.
Sure. Oh, you mean that was a question for me?
Yes. Yeah. Like, why do you do this? Like, so why can you just have DOM?
We cannot lock down. The DOM itself is obviously the DOM structure. It's the HTML structure of the page. We do not know if there will be, let's say, a massive structural design changes on the page structure, let's say, next week or in 2 months. Well, we know. But we claim the right to do that because we want to improve the page experience for you based on your investments. You're paying a monthly fee on the SharePoint Online, and we keep on evolving that based on our designs and experiences and input from the customers. Now, and that means that we can change the structure of the page to make it more, let's say, performant, more feature rich, and so on. So we have to have the flexibility of actually doing that. Now, there are certain exceptions, though, on the DOM manipulation. As long as you use our guaranteed placeholders, those placeholders actually exist.
But they are exposed through an API, right? So you're not injecting into a div on a page, but you're getting the reference to the div on a page through an API, and on that API is an SLA.
Absolutely. Now, this one from Jeff, kind of a similar kind of things. So he's basically how to hide a SharePoint Online launcher tiles menu using SPFX, which is how do I get rid of that one over there?
And the waffle. Sure,
waffle. How do you get rid of it? It's nothing more than actually, again, doing a CSS manipulation or a JavaScript manipulation, and then poof, getting rid of it. The question is, though, why would you do that? Sure, this is absolutely unsupported by Microsoft. And the question is, why would you want to hide the investments which you have done of Office 365 from your end users?
Maybe because you have your own tailored experience around that?
Sure, but then you cannot access any of the services on the waffle.
Maybe they have their own experience around that. Maybe they have their own LOB catalog of applications exposed to users.
Sure.
I don't know.
Sure. Theoretically, yes. But then that's actually, is it worthwhile? Is that the right design? Because then you're limiting out-of-the-box functionalities. And by the way, this piece of code can actually get broken anytime as well, because we might change the implementation. So again, DOM is not the API. DOM structure is not the API. You cannot guarantee that we will not change that. And that's, Jeff is calling that out quite visibly here as well, unsupported by Microsoft. So,
well, I think maybe another thing to add would be a comma can break any moment.
Yes. True. Absolutely. Now, if people are demanding that there should be similar capabilities like hiding the suit navigation or having extensibility on suit navigation, then yes, let's actually start collecting user voice feedback on that and votes on that one, and then we'll provide a native support for making that happen rather than hacking. The hacking is not a wise thing to do in SharePoint Online, definitely.
And also maybe an interesting point to that. Like, let's try to understand what you want to achieve with
yes.
that.
Yes.
So that maybe there's in the end a better way around it as opposed to hiding the element from the page.
Absolutely. Now, the following two are around the speed of SharePoint framework. So how do we increase the compilation or transcompiling page speed and performance when you're building a SharePoint framework solution? So the build performance might be slow if you have a large solution like SharePoint Starter Kit. And this is from Sergey around different things you can do to actually optimize the speed. So really good blog post on that. This actually relates, Ilio did a kind of a follow-up on that one as well, which is around speeding up SharePoint framework builds with the WSL2, because that's then faster on with NPM, right?
Correct.
So Windows subsystem for Linux is WSL. So basically running Linux in Windows, which if somebody would have told me that this is possible in 2018, back in 2000 and let's say 10 years ago, 2019. What year is it again? Okay. Here from Schwau. Save a modern SharePoint list as a template. And basically, how to use the PMP PowerShell to save a list as a template and export data, export and add data for a new list. Now, there is a export a list as a site design available as well, versus just the PMP templating engine. So there's multiple different options to use as well. But this is a nice script which is explaining how you can have a one, in this case, a PowerShell commandlet, which is then using the templating plus applying example content on that newly created template, newly created list as well. So. Good one. Here, creating Microsoft Teams using PMP, creating Microsoft Teams using PMP PowerShell Core and provisioning templates. That's really interesting. This is actually kind of getting a lot of attention as well. This is from Gautam Seth. Basically, as part of the latest versions of the PMP tenant templates, we support Teams templating as well. So you can use the Teams templates which are in a graph, or you can actually define the Teams template in the XML as well. And then you can use the PMP tenant templates to apply these Teams structures to any tenant in the world, and you'll get exactly the same end result, which is really cool. And obviously, what's the difference of the Graph API, which is available? Well, you can use just PowerShell, or you can combine this as part of a larger tenant template, which has site collections, site designs, site theming, configurations, and users even, or OneDrive, which are getting provisioned, and then add the team structure. And then you apply that once to a tenant, and both you'll get always the same end result. So not just the team specific thing, but also larger tenant structures. But good blog post on explaining how to make that happen, how to use PowerShell to make that happen, or how to use code, C# to make that happen. So really cool. Here, this one from I think this is a new person. We haven't actually seen this in the past, but this is around five ways to choose between List, Flow, SPFX, and Power Apps to build apps. Kind of a classic discussion point. When would I actually use SharePoint? When would I actually use Power Apps? When would I actually use Flow? And there was a nice...
It depends,
absolutely. Yeah. Nice table also here, which is then showing out SharePoint Framework, Azure Backend, complex application involving large data, Power Apps and Azure Backend has a different implications and all of that. And obviously, one maybe area which isn't mentioned in here is the licensing implications, which obviously has a value or impact as well. But good blog post from Alan. So I don't think we have seen blog posts from Alan in SPDev Weekly in the past. So good to have new people on the article side of as well. So this one is from Tom Cruise. No, just from Andrew Connell. So Ooh. How to use...
Who is that? new person, right?
Yeah. Automating build, testing, and deployment of SharePoint Framework projects with Azure Pipelines in 4 steps. So basically, he has good guidance on how to make it the Azure Pipelines automation easily available using YAML files. So really, really cool. Really, really easily doable for your SPFX solutions. So great blog post from Andrew on that. And then the final piece in here. Let's see if we can get a smiling Paolo.
If he smiles, it's probably at the start.
Yeah, that's true. That is true.
The very start?
There.
Yeah, there you go. Yes.
Sorry, Paolo. That's the long running joke as well. So basically, a video around how to run testing SPFX solutions at 1.9.1 solutions. And he's explaining that with an example, live demos, and all of that. So Paolo has this PSS Tech Byte series. This is episode 70, and these are really good videos, 10 minutes or less, covering a specific topic. So super useful, definitely. It's almost like what we're trying to do with SPDev Weekly, like 20 minutes, 30 minutes. This is like 1 hour.
And we never manage, right? Like, and I think this one will be, it's like we're talking already for a long time.
Yeah, I know. So let me stop presenting on there. So luckily you didn't have a customer meeting, or hopefully I didn't have a customer meeting. No, I didn't. I think it's that's it for now. For next week, we have Mark D. Anderson already queued up for having a discussion on interesting stuff what Mark has done in the past. Anything what's on your radar for this week, Walter?
A lot. We are experimenting.
So we have cool,
yeah, yes, exactly. So like working on products, we have few ideas that we want to try, and we're going basically through the target audience, to whom we want to introduce, how we want to introduce. So all the non-technical things that go into developing product and bringing it to market, because building is actually the easy part.
Yes.
Like worrying about the things like scale, performance. Sure. When you have people on it, you will take care of that. But first you have to get it to people, explain value, like why would they care? So basically going around all of that. And in a way, to be honest, I find it very intriguing, like how that works, the mechanics, how can you approach it, and what the options are.
Yeah. How do you find your customers? And that's actually interesting. That would be a completely separate 30 minutes discussion point, which is, even though you build the most awesome product in the world, if nobody knows about it, then
that is one. Awesome product? Two, can you explain the value? Like, why would anybody care? Yes. If you cannot do that, it might be the bestest thing in the world, the bestest. If you cannot explain the value, you will fail eventually.
If people are not getting interested in what you've done, and a simple example, maybe we'll close on this one. A simple example, which really, really bothers me, is whenever you put a blog, something in GitHub, the README file, please update that. The number one most important thing is the README file, because even though your code would be the most awesome thing when somebody compiles that or tests it out or transcompiles and runs the solution, if your README file doesn't explain what it is, why it's interesting, it should have a screenshot and an image or a GIF animation, even better, explaining, nobody's going to ever bother to check it out.
Yeah.
The README file is the most important thing almost in this project.
And there is room to explain like how you've done it, the hoops you've met, challenges you faced. So there's room for that. But the first things first, because if you don't capture people's attention at first, they will not invest in the less.
Correct.
Right?
Correct.
And also, like, try to make it basically the way you read article in paper. When you read the headline, you know everything.
Yep.
The further down you go, the more details you get.
Yes.
But there is no, like, build up, ta-da, and reveal.
Yep.
Because people lose attention. Nowadays, our attention spans are so short because there's overload of signals and info. So if you can really capture the audience with even things like image, like put image first. And everyone's like, I like it. That's interesting. Hey, I didn't know. And then they will read.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And then call out the key points and all of that. And then go to the further details and everything. That should be it. Every single blog post should be actually, this is why this matter. This is the thing. Why people should be reading this blog post. Start with that and then give them more context. Super, super important. But I think that's it. Thank you, Waldeck, for a great discussion. So, and like I said, next week, we'll have Mark D. Anderson joining us on the SPD Weekly episode. This is 53, so that's going to be 54. So, but I think that's it for this now. Thank you.
It is.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.